Okay, so good morning again. Thank you very much to the organizers for the opportunity to present our neutrino telescope project called Antares. So I speak here on behalf of the Antares Collaboration. Yeah, so our goal is to open up a new window to the universe doing neutrino astronomy, as you will see. So what are the motivations for this? Why do we want to do high-energy neutrino astronomy? Neutrinos are or can be unique cosmic messengers. So neutrinos point back right to the source because they don't have a charge. They don't get deflected in magnetic fields. They can travel cosmological distances, so they are stable particles as far as we know, so they will not decay. They can escape due to the very low cross-sections from optically thick sources. And neutrinos, as has already been pointed out, would be a clear sign for Hadron acceleration in the production side. So a detection of neutrinos could help us understand the origin and the acceleration mechanisms of high-energy hadronic cosmic rays in the universe. So where are the sites where these high-energy hadronic cosmic rays are made, actually? And neutrinos would provide also complementary information, of course, about sources, complementary to gamma rays and photons, as they are investigated by Pierre Auger, for example. So this is a little cartoon that shows that scheme again. So if you have a cosmic accelerator here, Earth here, and the only type of particles that would really transport the information undisturbed from the cosmic accelerator to Earth would be neutrinos. The protons and the gammas, they either get absorbed, or the protons, that their charged particles, they would get deflected, losing some of the information. Okay, so what do we think are high-energy neutrino production sites in the universe? So the scheme is the following. You always need a hadron accelerator, so either you have some shock front Fermi acceleration mechanisms to accelerate hadrons, or you have strong magnetic fields, for example, like you find them in pulsars or magnetars. And then once you have accelerated your hadrons, you need something like a beam dump. In particle physics, we talk about beam dumps usually, where we then have secondary particle production. So this would mean then that your protons, for example, as accelerated hadrons, would interact with some photon fields or matter somewhere in the interstellar medium, for example, and then the protons, when they interact with other protons or they interact with gammas, they would, of course, via the delta resonance, produce ions, which then cascade down again to muons and electrons, and on the way, they also produce the high-energy neutrinos, so the flavor ratio of 1 to 0, as you can see here, so 1 electron neutrino, 2 muon neutrinos, and 0 tau neutrinos, which then gets blurred to 111, of course, by neutrino oscillations over cosmological distances. And the photon neutrino connection, of course, is that if you have a de-excitation of the delta resonance, you also get neutral ions, which then decay into two gammas predominantly. So there have been many diffuse and point source neutrino flux predictions over the years. There's a reviews here, we can look them up. So we have some theoretical input about the fluxes. And this is a little cartoon which shows you some of these fluxes here. They are assumed neutrino fluxes. So this is the flux here on the y-axis. This is the neutrino energy. So I've taken this from a colleague in IceCube. This plot down here at very low energies, they are the cosmological neutrinos, so this is the analog to the cosmic microwave background. There are no good ideas how we could detect them up to now, really. Then these neutrinos have been detected, so solar neutrinos and neutrinos from supernova, from 1987A, for example. Then, of course, there are the reactor neutrinos, and here you see the spectrum of the atmospheric neutrinos, which constitutes the main background for searches with neutrino telescopes on Earth. And down here at this level, there would be a flux from neutrinos, high-energy neutrinos from AGN and the GZK neutrinos that are produced when protons or cosmic rays of the highest energies interact beyond 10 to the 19 eV with photons from the cosmic microwave spectrum. But there are different techniques, as you can see here, to detect the neutrinos in these different energy ranges. Okay, so what is actually the physics that you can do with a neutrino telescope? What results from all of this? So of course, you can try to do astronomy. This is the main target, so the main goal of neutrino telescopes. So we can have a look at galactic sources, of course, most promising being the supernova remnant, most likely, or extragalactic sources like gamma ray bursts, but I will not say anything about active galactic nuclei. Then, of course, we also have the possibility to try to indirectly detect dark matter if one assumes in supersymmetric models that the WIMPs are neutralinos that then annihilate into neutrinos again, then this gives a competitive way of indirect detection of dark matter, competitive with direct detection experiments that have come online over the last years in underground laboratories. Then there's the chance to see cosmogenic neutrinos, like the GK neutrinos of the highest energies, and some other physics opportunities like neutrino oscillations and also exotic physics like violation of Lorentz invariant, monopoles, nuclearites, and things like this can be looked at with neutrino telescopes. So what actually is Antares? Well, Antares, sorry for the contrast here, is the first particle detector that has been constructed in deep sea. So this is a little cartoon here, the submarine, which is actually not a joke, but we really do have submarine. So this is the layout of the Antares detector, so it consists of 12 lines, so-called lines. This is basically a cable, a long cable, which is held taut by a buoy, and an anchor, which is but this is just a dead weight that sits on the ground, in our case in the Mediterranean Sea at a depth of about 2,500 meters. We have 25 so-called stories of optical modules per line, so that the whole line is about 500 meters high. This is the Eiffel Tower here for comparison. Antares is taking data in its final 12-line configuration since May 2008. And the volume, this is something to keep in mind when we compare to IceCube, is something like 3% of a cubic kilometer. So this is actually a pilot project, and it's rather small. So this is the basic detector element. And this is one of these titanium stories that we have just seen as a photo on the previous slide. So we have three optical modules. These are glass spheres that house 10-inch PMTs. Photomultipliers from Hamamatsu. Then here in a cylinder, in a titanium cylinder, we have some electronics for the readouts, the digitization, and for calibration purposes, we do have hydrophones here and optical. Okay. So this is the basic story element, and we have 885 in total of these photomultipliers down in the deep sea. So the Antares collaboration who has built this instrument is a European collaboration made up of 27 institutions in 7 different European countries. The main player is France, of course. So these are some photos showing you how the strings get deployed, actually. So we have large vessels. This is a pellet holding a complete line with about 75 optical modules. Then we go out to sea. We have a crane, we lower these elements down, and then we use a submarine to pick up the cable, go to a junction box, and put the cable into the socket, so the plug into the socket to get high voltage and data readout connection. So where is it located? It's in the Mediterranean Sea. So this is Europe, the coast of France, and we are close to Toulon, so if you go out about 25 kilometers here to this place, you will find Antares at the bottom of the seafloor. You see that this is the continental shelf, and we are right beyond the deep sea. So this is the shore station, just to show off a little bit where we do our shift in this beautiful building here. So what is the status of high-energy neutrino telescopes in the world, so around the world in 2011? Cosmic Cars is not the only telescope, but it's the largest one in the northern hemisphere. There are two other pilot projects in the Mediterranean, NEMO and NESTO, but they are considerably smaller. And there's Baikal in Lake Baikal in Siberia, a Russian experiment, which is also smaller than Antares. And the big player, of course, is at the South Pole, with IceCube, with other cubic kilometer instrumented volume since last December. So what is the principle and the performance of such a neutrino telescope? So how do we actually detect neutrinos? This is done indirectly, as you will see. So some theory, so we have, can have charged current and neutral current interactions when a neutrino interacts with a nucleon. And the golden channel for astronomy is when a muon neutrino interacts in a charged current reaction with a nucleon and produces, first of all, a hadronic jet at the vertex. And then in the final state, a charged lepton, in that case a muon, which then can travel through the detector and be reconstructed because it emits, because of it, it's charged and goes with the speed of light, the vacuum speed of light. So it's faster than light in the water or in the medium it traverses. It starts to radiate off the rank of light at a certain angle. And the neutrino telescope is a three-dimensional matrix of photon multipliers, so we can record the time and the position where the photons have hit our strings, and from that we can reconstruct back the trajectory of the muon going through the detector. The amplitude, so the intensity of the light that reaches our photon multipliers, tells us something about the energy. And well, with this scheme, it's possible to reconstruct really be above a certain energy, so above 10 dB, the direction of the incoming neutrino to better or about 0.3 degrees. So this is the angular resolution that is possible for a neutrino telescope. So there's no detection without background, of course. So what is the particle background for a neutrino telescope? So this is the Earth. Here's our neutrino telescope. What we're interested in are cosmic neutrinos, but we have the atmosphere around the Earth, and we have, of course, cosmic rays impinging on Earth's atmosphere, creating cosmic ray air showers. And from these, we get muons, and we also get neutrinos, muon neutrinos. So in the case that the cosmic rays come from above, we have a large muon background. In the case that they impinge on the other side of the Earth, on the atmosphere, of course, you don't get the muons because they don't go through the Earth, but the atmospheric neutrinos, they travel through the Earth and also come up through the detector from the bottom of the sea. Right? So this is our main background when trying to detect cosmic neutrinos. And of course, this scheme also results in the fact that neutrino telescopes are usually optimized to be sensitive for particles that go upward. Particles that come from the sea ground upward. Okay, so this is a measurement that we have done. It shows the capability to suppress muon background. So this is the cosine of the standard angle. These are events. You see these are downgoing particles, these are upgoing particles, and you see this huge increase here. When you look over the horizon, you get all these atmospheric muons. And these are the neutrinos that come from below, so these are atmospheric neutrinos. And you see that we have a very good data Monte Carlo agreement. So we are very confident that we have the detector under control to a point that we are really able to discriminate between muons that come from above and the real signal that comes from below. This is a plot about the tracking quality. It's not so important in the moment. This is the angular resolution that we have determined for first data set that we have looked at, the first 3 years data taken during the commissioning and construction phase. And well, we are confident that we have a median angular resolution of 0.46 degrees for neutrinos, and that we have an absolute pointing of the telescope of 0.1 degrees. This was being measured in the moment of the surface array on a boat. But this should be the order of magnitude for the angular resolution and the absolute point. Okay, so what is the sky coverage of Antares? This is in galactic coordinates, of course, on Pirates it's here, and for comparison, Ice Cube here at the South Pole. Also, the visibility is shown for Ice Cube. And you see that the location in the Mediterranean Sea gives us a very good visibility of the southern sky. So we will be able to see the galactic plane, which Ice Cube is almost not able to, including the galactic center with a very high visibility here. In addition, we have some common view also with Ice Cube, which allows us to do some data analysis together with Ice Cube, which is a work which is in progress in the moment. So there are some advantages of being in the Mediterranean Sea. So what about first results? The first thing we have measured is the atmospheric muon flux to be sure that we understand our instrument. So this is the vertical intensity versus the depth. And of course, we are sitting at one depth, but you can look to the horizon, so you have a certain slant depth. And so you can measure its different water equivalent depth, so to say, and compare to other experiments. Black dots are the Antares data points, and we are very confident that we understand our muon background from above, having measured this depth intensity relation that was five lines at the very beginning. So the next thing that we have done is that we have determined an upper limit on the diffuse neutrino flux. So in the absence of detection of a signal, you can get an upper limit on the diffuse flux. So what you see here is the neutrino energy, and this is the diffuse flux normalization, assuming that you have an e to the minus 2 spectrum. So that was done also during the detector setup and construction phase for about a year. And you see that this has resulted in the best limit at that time. In the meanwhile, it has been superseded by a better limit done by Ice Cube a couple of months ago. But at that time, at the beginning of 2011, that was the best limit that was set on a diffuse flux. So this is the atmospheric neutrino flux here. And these are two diffuse flux predictions. So this is the Mannheim Crossrow-Rachen flux, which is a very optimistic one for optically thick sources. And this is the Waxman Pacall reference flux for neutrino telescopes. So you see that we have some factors above this Waxman Pacall flux here, excluding everything that is above here. For example, also excluding these models following Mannheim Crossrow-Rachen. And Ice Cube, in the meanwhile, is actually getting into this Waxman and Pacall limit here. So that was the flux limit that we could set in absence of a detection above the expected atmospheric neutrino background. So then more interesting, this is the first neutrino sky map that we are just publishing now. So you can find it in archive. So this is the first data from 2007 and 2008, also during the commissioning phase. So these are about 2,200 neutrino candidates that we have analyzed. And of course, there are different ways to do searches for point sources or to look for any excess over the atmospheric background. And I will show you this here on an updated sky map, which is not yet published, but which has already been shown at the ICRC. So this is now data from 2007 until and including 2010, so two more years of data with a different analysis where we have selected tracks of higher quality. So in total here we have a little bit more than 3,000 neutrino events measured. And well, we have done two searches. First of all, an all-sky search, so you don't make any assumptions about possible source location, but you do a maximum likelihood analysis with your point spread function and some assumption about the energy proxy for the complete sky, so fitting the coordinates of possible clusters and also fitting the number of signal events that you might find. And the most significant one, the hotspot, so to say, is in this position here, but it's not significant. It has a p-value of 2.6%. Then the second search that we have done is a candidate list search. So in that case, you predefine candidates, so known sources at the sky, and then you search for an axis over the atmospheric background for these known positions. So the difference is that you don't fit the position in that case, but you just fit the strength of the signal or the axis, so to say. And here, the best source is this HESJ-1023, but it has a p-value of 41%. So this is also not significant. So this is again about the method. So this was an unbinned search with a likelihood ratio. So this would be S statistic. And this is a list, I'm afraid you can't really read it, of the 51 sources that we have used in this candidate list search. And as I said, they are not significant at all. So the best one here has 41%, and most of them are at a p-value of 1, actually. Okay, so but we, of course, we don't have a detection over the background, but we can derive limits for the southern sky. So we say the neutrino flux can't be higher than a certain limit, otherwise we would have seen it with a telescope. Knowing our efficiency or effective area for the setup that has been used. So this is the sensitivity plot. So this is the flux limit here versus the declination. The black ones here are the first, the published points from the first point source search, and the blue points are the Antares, the updates of the Antares points for the 3-year period. And you see this is the median of the individual sensitivities on the 51 sources that we have looked at. And so this is the overall sensitivity or flux limit that we can set here. And you see that these are the best limits in the moment for the southern sky, because IceCube sitting at the South Pole looks mainly at the northern sky. They also have sensitivity for the southern sky, but they have to cut very hard in order to get rid of the muon background from above. So it was quite fast. So we're working on this, and you see that we are actually complementary here in our sensitivity to the IceCube, but of course there's some factor missing here to the sensitivity that IceCube has simply due to the fact that we are much, much smaller than IceCube. Okay. Another study that has been done that will be published as an autocorrelation study. So this is a search for deviations from the isotropy of the neutrino candidate distribution on the sky. This is a simple two-point autocorrelation function. So this is the significance in a certain angular distance. So what we do is that we count the cumulative number of neutrino pairs in increasing angular bins, and we compare this to the mean randomized sky. And, well, again, we don't find any significant excess. So the whole neutrino distribution that we have measured up to now, these 3,000 neutrino candidates, are completely compatible with the assumption that this is an isotropic atmospheric neutrino background. So then we have done a first time-dependent analysis. So the idea is to use high state time information from other experiments, like Fermi or HETS or SWIFT, so multi-wavelength studies of today. The idea is to use space and time coincidences to reduce the atmospheric neutrino background, so to become more significant. So this would, hopefully, we have studied this, improve the discovery potential over the time-integrated searches, where you just integrate over 3 years, as we have done. So we hope that this can improve the discovery potential when you look at interesting short periods of time. The method in the following is again an unbinned search using likelihood ratios, and we have optimized for the minimum flux necessary for a 5-sigma discovery. And we have done a search for flaring Fermi LUT lasers from September to December 2008. So we have analyzed up to now only a very small 3-month period. This is a shot in the dark, so to say, a first attempt analysis. This is the potential of this time-dependent analysis. So this is the average number of events per source required for 5-sigma discovery of a neutrino source as a function of the flare period width. Okay, so the AGNs that we have selected, they had a flaring which of at least one day up to something like 15 days or so. And this would be the number of events that you need for a time-integrated analysis to become 5-sigma sensitive, significant at a declination of minus 40 degrees. But if you do a time differential or a time resolved analysis, you get a factor of 2 to 3 improvement over this time integrated analysis. So if you go down to flare times of less than a day, you will need only 1 or 2 events to be significant over the atmospheric neutrino background. So we think that this is very promising, and we continued by taking or by identifying flare periods for 10 gamma sources, actually from this Elbas catalog and the first year Fermi catalog. And so the idea was to take the Fermi light curves, then define criteria, which we have done by ourselves, to detect flares, so to define flaring times, and then to use these times of the light curve where the flare happens directly as an input in the probability density function time distribution for the maximum likelihood search. And this has been done for 10 objects, and we have found one coincidence for one of the objects, that is 3C279, that we have already heard a lot about. And this is the joint Fermi-Antares data here. So we have at this flare here in the rising edge, so this is one bin data, I have to say, we have found one neutrino in coincidence. Of course, then you do a statistical analysis to see whether this is significant or not. And, well, unfortunately, we have found that this is, that this is not significant, so it has a post-trial probability of 10% and it's still compatible with the atmospheric background fluctuation. So pre-trial it is 1%, but we have looked at 10 sources, so we have a certain penalty factor because of these trials, and so we get this post-trial probability of 10%. Yeah, this is the event, actually. It has been reconstructed at an angular distance from the known position of this object of 0.56 degrees. And we have not yet used the energy. We are still in the stage that we work on reconstruction methods for the energy of an event. So this will certainly lead to another improvement, hopefully. Okay, little outlook on this time-dependent analysis. This is just the period that we have studied. So this is an example light curve of this object. And you see we have studied only this period, but there's within the data that we have with Antares, there are much larger flares. So this is very promising to look also at these flares here. And this is work in progress, of course. Then there's an idea to combine information from Antares and Fermi and the Tanami. The Tanami sources, they are all below 30 degrees here. And this happens to be the region where Antares has the greatest visibility. So we see that patch of the sky almost all of the time. So the idea is to develop a dynamic laser neutrino candidate is based on the variable GV Fermi sky and the jet production activity as it is revealed by Tanami, and to use this then as an input for the neutrino searches. Because as you have seen, this time-dependent analysis has a much better significance as these time-integrated searches. So the idea is to use short, high-luminosity peaks or these jet production activities as they are seen by Tanami as an input for our analysis to become more sensitive. Yeah, so just to show some Antares publications. So Antares has a very broad physics program, and I have no time to really talk about this. I think it should stop now. So there's much more which is being done. Maybe you allow me to say two words about KM3Net. So the future is KM3Net. As I said, Antares is just a pilot project. It's quite small, but of course we know that we need at least a cubic kilometer to be really sensitive. So the future is the KM3Net project, also for the Mediterranean Sea. So we are now in the preparatory phase. This is already an optical module that will most likely be used for KM3Net, comprising 31 photomultipliers. And this is just one third, this artistic impression, of the real volume of KM3Net. So it will be a multi-cubic kilometer array. And it will also be a large deep sea infrastructure for associated sciences, so marine biologists, oceanographers, and so on. They're all very interested in getting access to this deep sea infrastructure. The scientific goals, of course, are to view the galactic center, most of all. We think that we will need a budget of 220 to 250 million euros, but it's not yet funded, I also have to point out. And most likely, optimization will be done to observe supernova remnants predominantly in our galaxy. Yeah, so Fermi and Chansky and will there be Pauli added to to the meeting at one point? I hope so very much. This is just to flash the sensitivity curve from the technical design report for neutrino point sources. So this is IceCube, and this would be the sensitivity curve then for KM3Net, about 100 times in pars. And these red ticks here show interesting galactic sources that cannot be seen by IceCube, but because of the location on Earth of KM3Net, could be seen by KM3Net, including the galactic center. Yeah, so this is the timeline. Go through that, and this is my summary. Thank you very much.
We can follow up in the discussion. There may be time for one quick question.
So if they don't, neutrino astronomy has a problem, because the effect that has been reported by the Opera collaboration is a 10 to the minus 5 effect. So they claim that the neutrinos would be faster than the light. And, well, if you take into account the size of the galaxy, a 10 to the minus 5 effect would lead to the problem that neutrino astronomers would predict what using the optical in 1 year later. So this is the time that it can wait, actually. But for any extragalactic object that goes up to 1,000 So yeah, if this is confirmed, that this would be a problem.
Jeremy, is anyone looking at GPUs?
Well, up to now, this has not been done, of course, there are plans, but they have done that. Always a matter of power. Well, we have some very small overlap with HESS, but
yeah, but they don't have as much idea about
more
the
galaxy.
Let's carry on the discussion. So the thing, the last discussion, let's thank them again. Okay. So hopefully the last time, a couple of announcements.